Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kallik, and this is Dispatches. As Iran prepares for presidential elections, I'm joined by Navid Zarinal, who's visiting Lebanon from Iran to discuss developments in Iran from the coming elections to the tumultuous Trump years, relations with the Biden administration, as well as Iran's role in the region. Navid, welcome to Breakthrough News.
Thank you, Rania, for having me.
I'm so excited to just get into it. So like I said, you are visiting us in Lebanon from Iran. From what I understand, you'll be voting from here in the Iranian elections. Before we get into all of that, can you just start by introducing yourself? What have you studied, your academic background? What do you teach? And where have you been for the last year?
Sure. So my name is Navid Zarinal, and that's the anglicized version. So if you want to really Persianize it, you will say Zarinal.
I completely failed to do that, by the way, as everybody saw.
No. It was very good. For somebody who hasn't spoken Persian growing up, it was very good.
Well, thank you. So back to you.
Sure. I'm a PhD candidate at Columbia University, and I specialize in Iranian history. And also I'm interested in theories of imperialism and post-colonial theory. And I've been living in Iran for the past year and a half, doing archival research, but also just living there. And I'm based between US and Iran, so I move back and forth a lot for research and other things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. You were in Iran for all of COVID, which we can get into as well. But I guess let's first start with the fact that, you know, right now Iran is, of course, in the news for two reasons. So let's start there, right? The elections and, of course, the nuclear talks between Washington and Tehran. So let's start with the elections. Outside observers usually divide the Iranian political scene between the reformers and the conservatives, or the hardliners, as they're often referred to. And so I guess let's start with, is that an accurate representation, or is that simplistic? And what policies actually differentiate these two camps?
That's right. So I think in order to talk about the reformers and the so-called hardliners, it's important to have some context, because I think a lot of Westerners and Americans kind of come to the binary of reformers and hardliners without really knowing the context. So if you want to approach it with the historical context, what you have before the Iranian Revolution that happens in 1979 is you have a number of parties and political groupings. Not all of them are officially parties, but they're political collectives that are organizing against the Shah. And so one group are the Mossadegh allied nationalists, so the nationalists that were active during the Mossadegh years. And as your viewers might know, Mohammad Mossadegh was the democratically elected prime minister of Iran, who tried to nationalize Iranian oil in 1951. And then he was overthrown by a CIA-backed coup d'etat in 1953. So you have his partisans that are organizing from 53 to 1980. And a big example of them is Nehzat-e-Azadi-e Iran, or the Liberation Movement of Iran. So that's one camp. For the second camp, you have the communists. So Tudeh Party, for example, was a communist political party. And then you also have the Islamic socialist hybrids that were influenced by the ideology of intellectuals such as Ali Shariati, who were trying to synthesize Shiism with Marxism. And an example of this grouping is the MEK. And then in addition to, so the Mossadegh ally nationalist, then you have the communists, then you have the Islamic and socialist hybrids, but then you also had Islamic parties that were not interested in socialism or communism. And of the most successful of them that actually consolidated power after the revolution was the Islamic Republican Party. So the Islamic Republican Party consolidates power in competition and exclusion of other political parties and groupings that were active after the revolution. And then the so-called reformists and the hardliners, they were all part of the Islamic, or most of them at least, were part of the Islamic Republican Party in the 1980s when Iran was fighting the Iran-Iraq War and the revolution was in its younger days. But what happens is starting in the 1990s and after is that there's a split in the Islamic Republican Party. So you have the reformist people like Khatami, who was president, the president of Iran, and the reformists, their demands were things like the liberalization of the public sphere and also the liberalization of the economy and also more contact with the West. And even some of them wanted full normalization with the U.S. and to this day still want normalization with the U.S. So that's what the reformists kind of believe in. And the indigenous Persian term for it is Islah Talab. And then the so-called hardliners, and this is the term that is not indigenous. So if you actually follow Iranian and Persian media, they will not have an equivalent of the hardliner, even though sometimes, I mean, they try to translate these terms back into Persian, but we don't really have an indigenous term for hardliner. But the so-called hardliners, who most of them belong to the principalist political party, and you can also call them Enghilabi or revolutionary. This group believes in the resistant economy and very strong national production to limit import dependency as much as possible. And they also believe in cultural authenticity. And I think a third point on foreign policy is that a limited engagement with the West and also having a resistance of foreign policy with countries like Yemen and Iraq. And so on. So that is the split that happens in the 1990s. So the reformist on the one hand and the people who were more revolutionary, more ideologically revolutionary on the other, or the so-called hardliner. And one last point that I have to mention is that the reason I think the hardliner terminology is simplistic is because it's from the perspective of the West. So it's from the perspective of what West has as its priorities in the international order. And there's a really interesting colonial background to this. So if you actually look at the British sources from the 19th century, whoever in the global South was advocating rebellion against colonial rule, they were called the extremists or the hardliners versus the moderates, right? So another term the reformers are identified with that is not indigenous to Persian is moderates, right? Even though, again, they translated back into Persian. But so the moderate extremist or the moderate hardliner, that has a colonial legacy behind it. And in this case, too, I think because the revolutionaries or the principalists want limited engagement with the West, and they're very cautious because of colonial history, and they don't want to liberalize the economy, they are labeled as hardliner, and I guess not extremists yet, but they call them the hardliners.
What's interesting to me is that when we think about these terms like conservative and hardliner, if you actually look at what you just described, I mean, just objectively speaking, especially in economic terms, it actually sounds like the so-called reformists are more conservative when it comes to the economy versus the so-called hardliners or conservatives are actually more to the left on the economy. Like you were talking about the conservative hardliners. I don't know what word to use in English, but you were talking about what we in the West would call hardliners as being more interested in not being so import dependent, right? So having some economic sovereignty and the ability to produce your own material. Whereas when we think about the word reformist, it's actually referring to people like you mentioned who want to liberalize the economy. So that's actually a more conservative economics. So that's what's so ironic to me. But then again, it shouldn't be so ironic because you mentioned the word moderate. And then when we think about the way the word moderate is used by the West, it's also used to refer to the people in Syria that we called moderate rebels who actually were like Al-Qaeda linked jihadists. That's so right. I'm glad that you broke that down because it's absolutely connected to colonial terminology. When we think when the West comes up with words like hardliner versus reformist, they're really just referring to what it means for Western interests.
100%. And I mean, that's an excellent point because the term conservative is actually a misnomer here. And if you're actually reading the English press right now, they refer to Sayyid Ibrahim al-Ra'isi, who is one of the more revolutionary, so the characteristics I describe, resistant economy, cultural authenticity, limited engagement with the West, Sayyid Ra'is Ibrahimi has those policies, and he's identified in the Western press as an ultra conservative. But there's nothing conservative about that, right? So if you actually want to liberalize the economy and the culture and the political culture and so on, you can say that's actually more conservative. Or put differently, if you want to go along with a liberal world order, that's a more conservative position, in my estimation. So I think, yeah, this term of hardliner, conservative, ultra conservative, they don't really apply.
So back to the election issue, I mean, do you expect any major changes? How would you, and maybe let's take a step back and explain to our listeners and viewers, because of course the only representation or interpretation of the Iranian political system we ever get in the US media is that it's some sort of theocratic dictatorship, but it's actually way more complex than that. And there are elections that people vote in on both the local and national level. So that said, how would you define Iran's political system? We know there's elections, there's different candidates with diverging opinions, but then we're also hearing that some of them have been disqualified by the Guardian Council. So why is that, and what does that mean in the broader context of Iran's political system?
Yes, and that's a great question. So in terms of describing the Iranian political system, I think the best description is, or the best phrase is a theocratic democracy or theocratic republic. So that is, you have constitutionally in Iran, you have certain powers reserved for the clergy, for the Shia clergy, and then you also have popular and democratic representation. So it's a hybrid of those. To the Western experience and the European experience, this sounds very contradictory and oxymoronic, right? Because the Western experience is that liberal democracy emerges in distinction to the Catholic Church, right? So the idea is that you actually want to eliminate a theocracy in order to have democracy. But the Iranian experience is actually very different. And I think when people say that, oh, theocratic republic or democracy is a contradiction, they don't really understand that the Iranian experience is not the same as the Western experience, right? And if you actually look at the history of the Shia clergy in Iran, historically, they were popular with the masses, and they were also a safeguard against the power of the ruler or the sultan, or the Shah, right? So they would try to safeguard the, not all of them, but many of them would try to safeguard the interest of the community against the ruling dynasty, right? So it's the Christian and the Western history is very different than the Iranian one. So in that sense, I think theocratic democracy is not an oxymoron. And also, I mean, if you compare it with liberalism, I mean, in liberalism too, if you read, for example, the writings of John Rawls, what liberal theorists try to do is that they try to reconcile liberty with equality, right? So, I mean, at its face, it might sound oxymoronic that the liberty of the capital-owning class can be reconciled with the equality of the working classes, but that's what welfare democracies have been trying to do for the past several decades. And so what they try to do is that they try to reconcile the liberty of the capital-owning class with the equality of the working classes. So they put the welfare state in. So just as you can reconcile liberty and equality under liberalism, I don't see why you cannot reconcile theocracy with democracy. You have some powers for the clergy and some power for the voting masses.
That's actually a really good point. And then as for, you know, the issue of, you know, what we've been hearing in the U.S. about the elections as candidates, certain candidates being disqualified. What is happening with that? Why have certain candidates been disqualified?
Yes. There is a consul.
And actually, I do want to preface that to say, before you actually get into the details of that, that I do think that there's this kind of like moral superiority that we have, or that the Western media absolutely has, especially coming from the U.S., where you literally have to raise millions of dollars, maybe even $1 billion, to successfully run for president. And we actually do have pre-qualified candidates. I just want to say that because it's always interesting to me that these U.S. pundits feel like they're in a position to talk down to any other country about democracy when the U.S. doesn't really have one. But anyways, please continue with your
response. That's an excellent point. And in fact, if you want to compare the Guardian Council with corporate financing in the U.S., the Guardian Council actually has indirect representation from the people, but I don't think you can make the same case for big capital and big corporations in the U.S. that try to control the elections. And so if you actually want to look at the constitutional process of the Guardian Council or the Shura-i Negahban in the Iranian context, so the public votes for the Assembly of Islamic Experts, and then the Assembly of Islamic Experts chooses the leader, and then the leader chooses the Guardian Council. So in that chain of succession, you see that the Guardian Council is indirectly linked to popular representation. So there is a limited amount of popular representation behind the Guardian Council, at least in the constitutional process. Right, and then what happens is that it's a much shorter cycle compared to the American elections. So if you're used to the U.S. elections, you know, you have these candidates that run about a year and a half before the actual election day, and then you have nonstop, basically trash on TV that's difficult to watch, including some of the debates. So it's a year and a half process. It's just very long, and at some point, I want to lose interest, but then it's also entertaining. So,
well, it's like reality TV, but like political reality TV in America.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, it is reality TV. So it's long and tiring, but with the Iranian one, it's what happens is, and I'm not making a value judgment on the Iranian one, whether the shorter duration is good, but as a descriptive matter, about 6 weeks to 8 weeks before the election, the candidates register, and many candidates from different political ideologies register. And then what happens is that the Guardian Council approves or disapproves of the candidates, and usually you have about 10 or less, something between 5 to 10, that remain for the election. And then a month before, you have a number of debates, and then people go and vote. And this year, it'll be this Friday. That's when the voting day is. But another, I think, important point here is, even though the Guardian Council's mandate does have anti-democratic qualities to it, if you're reading the English press right now in the Iranian elections, they are making it like, you know, there's no ideological diversity between the candidates that the Guardian Council approve. But you actually do have ideological diversity. So there's a candidate, Mohsen Meher Alizadeh, who is a Khatami appointee, and he was also the governor during Rouhani's rule, and he's more from the reformist camp. And you also have Hemmati, who is the director of the central bank, and he has reformist inclinations. He has even expressed interest in meeting Biden one-on-one, which would be the first high official meeting of this kind since the revolution, if you don't count Javad Zarif meeting with Kerry during the nuclear negotiations. So you have these candidates, and then you also have the principalist candidate, or the candidate I mentioned before, Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, whose ideology matches the leaders more. So you have this diversity, but the English press has made it out like, you know, there's no diversity whatsoever. And I think the reason is this time the reformist candidates haven't really galvanized reformist passion, especially in the diaspora, as much. So if you talk to diaspora Iranians, they're like, we don't have any candidates that are interesting, right? So I think that's one reason there's...
I see. You know, it's also interesting to me, watching mainstream media in the U.S., I heard this like segment, I can't remember what channel it was on, but it was a report about the Iranian presidential elections and all these candidates have been disqualified. And the reporter was lamenting the fact that Ahmadinejad had been disqualified. And I'm just thinking to myself, but you guys hated this guy when he was president. Like, the U.S. media couldn't stop vilifying him when he was president. And now you're going to cry because he's disqualified? Like, what, are you going to intervene in Iran because Ahmadinejad, the guy you wanted to overthrow 10 years ago, is disqualified? Like, that just made me laugh from just a pure hypocritical standpoint. But no. Go ahead. Sorry if you want to respond to that.
With Ahmadinejad, too, I mean, I think he's been tweeting out of his English account about basketball and American football and Tupac. I mean, I love Tupac, but I just don't understand. Like, he's really trying to connect with Americans or whoever is running his Twitter. Probably with his approval. So maybe that's one reason. I mean, there's definitely that hypocrisy, but I think there's also this kind of, oh, well, this guy might not be as bad as we thought he was. So because
he likes about, America now.
Yeah, because he likes American football. So.
Okay, so I guess moving on from the issue of the elections, in your view, do most Iranians want the restoration of the nuclear deal first signed between the Obama administration and Iran? And did that deal bring relief to people back when it was signed? Because after Trump, there's this new trend of, you know, mistrust, you know, that the U.S. doesn't want to offer concessions at all. And even if they say they will, they'll renege on those concessions. So I guess what's the view from your time spent in Iran over the last year or so that you've been there? What's your impression of people's desire to either go back to the deal or not?
That's right. I mean, I would say in terms of going back to the deal, there's a good degree of popular support for it. And I think even Raisi, who is one of the more revolutionary candidates or in the English nomenclature hardliner candidates, I think he's even expressed interest in going back to the deal. So there's that. But then it's not really about the deal. Rather, most Iranians want sanctions relief, right? Yeah. So from the shopkeeper to the politician to the teacher, to the global savvy traveler, they want sanctions relief, right? So, and if the nuclear deal is a means to sanctions relief, then they embrace it. Although, I mean, even with the sanctions, the Iranian economy hasn't suffered as much as the West and its allies wanted to. But at the same time, Iranians do want sanctions relief. And regarding changes after the nuclear deal, the second part of your question. So I remember when the nuclear deal was signed in the summer of 2015. I was actually in the Arab world, and then I traveled back to Iran, and I went, you know, the subsequent years too, before Trump pulled out of the deal in May of 2018. And not much had changed regarding what U.S. was supposed to deliver. So I mean. I don't think Iran could transact on the international banking system, so they couldn't. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to pay someone from an Iranian bank, or you know some big company in Iran wanted to pay a company in Europe, I don't think they were able to do that. So that wasn't accomplished. And even there were deals at the elite level after a nuclear deal. So Iran Air, the Iranian airline company, had a very big contract with Boeing, the Chicago-based plane company, and Boeing never delivered the planes, as far as I know. Boeing never delivered the planes, and I mean, I guess their excuse was that, well, Trump is president, and he might want to withdraw from the deal, so we're not going to deliver on the planes until we know what's going to happen, right? So not much changed. I mean, so Iran wasn't really doing business with the outside world in a open manner, and another important thing is the currency value. So the currency value didn't improve from the time the deal was signed to the time that Trump withdrew, and after he withdrew, the value of the currency actually collapsed. I mean, it collapsed. So it lost value by 7 times.
Wow.
Yeah, so
that's devastating. I don't think people understand what that means. I mean, when a currency devalues, it means, I mean, just because our most of our viewers and listeners are Western, and they don't have to deal with this kind of stuff. But if your currency loses value, like to that degree, let's say 7 times, like you just said, that means your salary, if you make $7,000 a year, goes from $7,000 in dollars, like the equivalent in dollars, goes from being worth $7,000 to being worth $1,000 a year.
Yes.
It's completely devastating on people's livelihoods when that happens.
It is indeed. And I mean, the thing is, when it comes to the consumption of domestic goods, some of them get inflated because of the currency devaluation. But because Iran has a very strong national industry and also national food production, food prices don't go up as much. But then if you're buying imported goods, so if you want to buy an imported car or an imported laptop, because Iran doesn't make laptops, then the price of laptops is astronomical. I mean, what you have to pay for a laptop, I mean, in the U.S., or in the EU, I mean, you pay what, maybe 1500 euros or $1,300 for a good laptop. But then that price you have to pay in dollars if you're buying a laptop, say an HP or a Microsoft Surface or an Apple, right, especially because it's an American company in Iran. So yeah, it can be very difficult, and also it makes travel difficult. So if you want to travel, so I mean, because the value of the Lebanese lira was also devalued, might be easier to travel between Iran and Lebanon. But if you wanted to go to a country that has a stronger currency, then you basically cannot go. Or if you want to buy a plane ticket, it becomes very difficult. So what the sanctions are doing is the currency devaluation. I think that's a consequence of the sanctions. And then it also makes it difficult for all these Iranians to be connected to the outside world, to actually travel and see their neighbors and so on.
You know, and that kind of leads into the next question I wanted to ask you, which you kind of answered a little bit, but I'd love to delve deeper into it a bit, because you have spent the last year or so in Iran, like we mentioned. And so, you know, from what you just described, I mean, just being on the ground and seeing the way people of different classes are having to deal with the consequences of things like currency devaluation and other ways that sanctions impact, you know, how have sanctions affected people in a real material sense? And how have they coped? And are there signs, I mean, you've kind of mentioned some of them, but are there signs that Iran has increased its own self-sufficiency and managed to create an alternative economy that's less vulnerable to the consequences of sanctions from the U.S.?
That's right. So, I mean, the policy of the leader especially is one of resistance economy. So the leader gives a new name to every new year. So the Iranian New Year was on March 20th. And for the past several years, the leader has focused on giving the name of a national production or production leap. Some of the names are very long, and it's not very good for the year to have such a long name, but the basic idea is national production. So the official policy is one of resistance economy and national production. But then the problem is that the consumer habits and other limitations don't always make it easy. So the thing is, Iran actually produces really amazing hygienic products, for example. So if you want to buy, you know, shampoo, cream, whatever, going to the pharmacy or the store, if you want to get these things, the Iranian-made ones are just as good, if not better, as the competitors from the outside. But the problem is that the consumers like to buy foreign products because it kind of has a prestige, and they're like, oh, you know, I'm cooler if I bought a European-made product. So a lot of times I'm buying a cream, and I'm looking very hard at where it's made. So I actually look at all the fine print, and then I'd actually see that it's produced in Iran, and I buy it. But then I get tricked because, for example, on the lotion, there's a big Canadian flag, or there's a big Swiss flag, even though there's no connection whatsoever to Canada or Switzerland in a lot of cases.
That's actually clever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is there an argument to be made, or is there anybody making the argument that Iran shouldn't concede at all and go back to a nuclear deal? Is that even a part of the conversation? Or is it kind of an across the board, we need to get back into this deal?
Yeah. I mean, there are certain parliamentary sessions where members of parliament kind of make a big fuss, and they're like, no, the nuclear deal is bogus, and you cannot. And yeah, also asked about trust, like you cannot trust the U.S. after Trump withdrew. I mean, you cannot trust them because of the 1953 coup d'etat against Mohammad Mossadegh, but you can also not trust them because Trump unilaterally withdrew from the deal. So there are those conversations in the parliament, but I would say that generally, most politicians and especially the people are open to going back to the deal. But I mean, one strong argument that can be made against the return to the nuclear deal at a more kind of idealistic and theoretical level is that the nuclear deal was never about nuclear weapons, and it was never about world peace and security, even though that's the PR that it gets. The real reason is imperialist domination. And there's actually a very similar history of the nuclear deal in Iranian history. And if you would let me indulge you for a second in a historical illustration, hopefully your viewers will also like it. But basically, so there's a really interesting precedent to the nuclear deal So what happened in the late 19th century, around the turn of the 20th century, so about 120 years ago, I was reading the memoirs, the diaries of Ihtisham al-Saltaneh, who was an aristocrat in the Qajar court at the turn of the 20th century. And the Qajar court was a dynasty that ruled before the Pahlavis and Mohammad Reza Shah, who the U.S. backed. He was part of the Pahlavi dynasty. But the Qajar dynasty was before them from about 1798 to 1921. And so at the turn of the 20th century, Ihtisham al-Saltaneh speaks about this deal that the Iranian government had with Britain. And the deal was basically that no military-grade weapons can enter Iran. So all military weapons are banned from entering Iranian territory. And the reason the British had given was that they did not want the Afghan tribes that were not under British control to be empowered. And also they did not want the nomads who were by the Persian Gulf region to be armed to, you know, fight the British, because British had interest in the Persian Gulf that would connect them to India. And what's interesting is that the Iranian government actually did not put up a fight, because in the case of currently, they had definitely put up a fight against the the nuclear deal impositions that the U.S. wants to put on them. But at that time, because the Iranian government itself was scared of the nomads in the Persian Gulf region, such as the Bakhtiaris, thinking that if they're armed, then they will pose a threat to the central government in Tehran, they did not put up a fight. And they said, okay, we will not import any military weapons, to the point that if somebody wanted to bring an official gift, like a weapon, to a minister at the courts in Tehran, there would be a lot of obstructions against us. So they would try to prevent the minister from receiving just one weapon, right? So history repeats itself. Just as the British were imposing imperialist domination of the region and forcing Iran not to import military weapons, in a similar way, the U.S. right now does not want Iran to have nuclear weapons, not because it cares about world security and peace, but because of imperialist domination. So there is a strong argument against concession, because the question is, why should these double standards exist if the U.S. is a country that actually threatens world peace through invading countries like Iraq? Why is it Iran that should not have a nuclear weapon? Or the U.S. has used nuclear weapons against Japan, but they get to have it and Iran doesn't. So there's this double standard and there's no equality of sovereignties here. So I think if you're against imperialist domination and if we are for equality of sovereignties, then Iran should not concede. But then whether this idealistic argument fit the political reality, that's a different question. And as history tells us, global South nations do have to concede and compromise on some of these issues.
Of course. At the end of the day, there's also the issue of Israel. Israel gets to have a nuclear weapons in the region. And that's not to be ever questioned, right? It's just a given. We're just all supposed to accept that as the default. When Israel is the most aggressive power in the region, meanwhile, Iran hasn't, you know, invaded any countries. And it certainly has not attacked any countries. Yet Iran is supposed to be the one that we're scared of having, you know, that we're scared if Iran has a nuclear weapon. It's, you know, when you actually think about it, it doesn't make any sense. And at the end of the day, it's, of course, a completely unequal system of the global north gets to have nukes, the global south doesn't. And that's the end of the discussion. And it's all, like you said, imperial domination.
And the problem is that the English press never approaches it this way. So there's never this fundamental, even in the op-eds, you never find or rarely find any mention of these issues. So
it's just this like paternalistic view too of the U.S. where the U.S. has nuclear weapons to protect everyone or something, whereas, you know, Iran wants them for negative reasons, or North Korea wants them for, you know, sadistic reasons, or when in fact most countries who want nuclear weapons want them as a form of deterrence. And that's the reason the West and the global North don't want these countries to have them, because it would be deterrence. It would deter other countries from aggressive maneuvers against them. And you can't dominate a country if it has nuclear weapons, or at least it's more difficult to dominate. So you have, you know, you were in Iran during the recent Israeli war on Gaza. In your experience, how do Iranians feel about Israel, about Palestine, about resistance? I know you can't, not every Iranian feels the same way, but generally speaking, and do their positions on this conflict and Iran's role in the region differ based on things like class and education and geographic region?
That's right. A very good question. And I would say that there is diverse support for the Palestinian cause. And it's actually one of the early values of the revolution. So the revolution had two major values. One was class equality, and the other was the support for the Palestinian cause. And the value of class equality was a lot more difficult to accomplish, and it's become probably faded over the years. But the support for the Palestinian cause is something that I would say has remained consistent as a revolutionary value. So it's the official ideology of the state. And if you go around Tehran or any city in Iran, oftentimes you find murals that have a representation of the Palestinian cause and a stand in solidarity with Palestine. There's actually a really nice square called the Palestine Square in Tehran that has murals of for Palestinians and in support of the Palestinian cause. So you have this state ideology that's behind Palestine, but it's not just the state, also civil society. So a lot of artists, writers, intellectuals, they also support Palestine, even if they don't identify with the state ideology and might support it on different grounds or within a different social network. In fact, there was this leftist economist named Fariborz Reisdana, who unfortunately passed of COVID-19 about a year ago. And in one of his last interviews, he said that I'm not religious, so I don't support Palestine based on any Muslim solidarity, but I support it as a human issue. And so you have that example. So the state and civil society both support Palestine. But then you have a second position, I would say second position, and that's a position of indifference. Mm-hmm. So, and this is interesting because when you talk to the Western left or to American leftists, there's still interventionist in some sense, right? So if, say, something is happening in Venezuela, they will back the anti-imperialist forces or the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, and they're very engaged with it, right? They have to have an opinion, they have to engage with it, talk about it. And then the liberals and the right-wingers then oppose the anti-imperialists and support the liberal candidates or the candidates that are allied with the U.S., right? So there's this interventionist impulse across the spectrum in the U.S. political discourse. But then in Iran, actually, a lot of people just don't really have an interest in giving opinions or in even engaging with other countries' affairs. So, you know, if you ask an Iranian, well, what do you think about Venezuela or Palestine? They will say, I hope the people of that country figure things out. And, you know, it's not my issue. Right. So you also have that position. And it's not an anti-moral position. It's not an unethical position. It's just a position that I don't want to intervene. It's a different country. It has its own sovereignty and let them decide things. Even though in the case of Palestine, I mean, there's not official sovereignty, but you get my point.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those are the two positions, and there's a nasty position, a third position that's a reactionary position, and that is the whatever the state says. So if I oppose the state, I will also oppose Palestine. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of, reactionary is the best term for them, that just because the Islamic Republic supports Palestine, they will side with Israel, and they will just repeat a Zionist talking point. So a lot of times I've heard people I repeat the land purchase theory that, well, the Zionists and Israel just purchased all the land, and so they're entitled to it, and there was no expulsion, there was no Nakba, none of that. But even Zionist sources dispute that, and I think it was something, so from the late 19th century when the Zionists settled in Palestine for the next 60 years, I think the Zionists only purchased about 7% of the land. So, and then after that, there was a conquest and they took over. But then there's this talking point among these reactionaries that no, you know, Israel bought all the land, so they're entitled to it. So there's that. And also part of that reactionary position is that, well, I don't want my money spent on the Palestinians. So if they need something, if they need aid or weapons, I don't care. All the money should be spent inside of Iran. And I mean, this position that I don't want our money to be spent on them, I guess, could be somewhere between the indifference position and the reactionary position. But I think it's more the reactionary position mm-hmm. that, you know, just spend all the money on me, the Iranian, not the Palestinian.
And is there a class or educational division in the sorts of people who might support one position over the other? Or is it kind of those splits exist across class and educational lines?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, anything I would say on this would be anecdotal, so I better mm-hmm. not speculate. So,
That's a great thing you just said, by the way. No one in America ever feels the need to say that. I wish Western pundits would know when they are like limit, like when they should say, okay, you know, I'm not quite sure. I can't generalize, but I'm sorry. I finished your thought.
No, you're right. I mean, no, I'm being honest. I mean, honestly, I haven't studied demographics on the Palestinian issue in Iran. So I don't really know how it's divided across demographics. Let me
actually include this element to it, because this has that sort of division you could speak to. But similar to the Palestine issue, how do Iranians feel about their government's regional interventions in places like Syria, Iraq, Yemen? How is this justified? And does it receive support from the general population? Or are there also divisions, and are those divisions similar to what you just described with the Palestinian issue?
No, there are divisions, and the divisions, a big one is, again, this position of indifference. So a lot of them say that, well, this is an issue for Yemenis, issue for Syria, even if the Syrian government invites Iranian forces or say, you know, the Houthis want Iran to engage, a lot of Iranians would still say that, no, this is not for us to intervene in. So I would say the non-interventionist mindset is a lot stronger in Iran compared to the U.S. because Americans are just ready to intervene in anything.
Right.
But, you know, start an NGO. I mean, and the thing is, what I find funny is that whatever is happening in the world, so somebody could have just found out about Maduro or about some elections in Bolivia, and the immediate impulse they have is that I have to have an opinion. You know, I have to, you know, call on the UN and call on everyone. So even if the American Organization of States is not a reliable source for monitoring elections, if, you know, they say anything, all these Americans will have an opinion and they want to, you know, call on the NGOs and the UN and the IGOs and everyone to get involved to do something about the elections, even if there's no credible claim of cheating. Same with the so I mean it's very non-interventionist, the mindset. So a lot of Iran, and again, I don't know majority minority here, I don't have clear data, but a lot of Iranians are non-interventionists, and they say, you know, we don't want to get involved in these issues. But then there's a second position, similar to the support for Palestine on Yemen, Syria, and Iraq, and that is either based on Shia solidarity or human solidarity. So a lot of them say that these are Shia brothers and sisters. And it's also in Afghanistan. So when the Hazara community was targeted recently and several girls, schoolgirls were killed, there was a lot of a sense of Shia solidarity. And there were events outside the Afghan embassy in Tehran. And it's similar with Yemen and Iraq and Syria. So if they're Shia brothers and sisters or Shia holy sites, the idea is that we have to support them, right? So that's very different than a non-interventionist position. And then there's a human one. So the same people who support the Shia brothers and sisters would also support them because, you know, it's a matter of oppression, right? It's a human issue, right? And then there are people who don't have a strong Shia identity, and they just support it based on human grounds that, well, there's this brutal international war that's being waged against Syrian sovereignty. And they might have an opinion and want to get involved. And there's a third position I should mention too. So the indifference, the Shia and human solidarity, and the third is a security position. Mm-hmm. Similar to any country that might have a foreign policy, the idea is that, well, if something is happening in Iraq, so if Daesh is taking over Iraq, it might have consequences for Iran because we share a border. So based on a security perspective, we have to get involved. So there's also that position. And I guess that might be shared more by the politicians.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you too. Is there that element of, okay, well, the existence of ISIS in places like Syria and Iraq could have a huge destabilizing and actually existential do existential damage to Iran if it is allowed to thrive and continue to grow. That said, I'm curious how Iranians feel about improving ties with China. Is there any kind of conversation happening in Iran, whether politically or generally in the media or among the population, about the idea of whether China can in any way free them from relying on making deals with the West?
That's right. Yeah, and that's a very timely question, because on March 27th of 2021, this past March, the Chinese foreign minister came to Iran, and Iran and China signed a 25-year cooperation agreement that the Western media, including the Persian media based in the West, was misrepresenting as some sort of a colonization project, even though there's no evidence for that yet. But there's actually an interesting background to it, because after a nuclear deal was signed in 2016, President Xi came to Iran, and the Rouhani administration was not interested in having extensive cooperation with China at the time, because the idea was that, well, we don't want to alienate the West and the Europeans, and we want to have these engagements with Europe after the nuclear deal. So they kind of gave a cold shoulder to China, from what I've understood. But then most recently, especially after Trump withdrew from the agreement, the idea is that China would be a good ally for economic and perhaps other forms of cooperation. So that 25-year cooperation agreement was signed. As far as I know, the text hasn't been released, so the details aren't fully clear. But then what is kind of ironic is that when the nuclear deal, and this is again anecdotal from what I hear on the streets, but then what happened is after the nuclear deal, nobody was saying that, oh, they sold out our nation. So the idea was that, okay, we'll get sanctions relief, and you know this might be a good thing. So nobody had this idea that the nation has been sold out, right? But then when the China deal was reached, I remember for about a month, if you would go to the shops and if you would go in the taxis or your families, whatever, who are you talking to, they had this idea that they have sold the nation to China. And I think it goes back to our representation by Western medias that this is a colonization project by China, even though there's no evidence for it yet. So there was that. And what's ironic is that actually the nuclear deal compromise Iranian sovereignty. Again, we're talking about should Iran concede. So the nuclear deal actually minimized Iranian defense capabilities, right? But this deal with China has no demands like that. It seems the political and military demands are not similar. So China is not asking Iran to stop making weapons and so on, right? So the irony is there. And so there was that kind of popular perception of the agreement with China. But then the other thing is in terms of, well, whether the second part of your question, whether making deals with China will help Iran against the relying on the West. Iranian policy is, and this is a slogan of the revolution, that neither East nor West, the Islamic Republic. So the idea is that they don't want to rely on Eastern powers nor on Western powers. Rather, they want to have an indigenous economy, and they want to have their independence and sovereignty. So the Iranian mindset is that China cannot free us from anything, right? So, I mean, the thing is you can have deals with different countries and with different power zones, but the idea is that at the end of the day, you have to be self-sufficient and rely on yourself. So I think that's a shared kind of sentiment from the elite level to the popular level that you can make a deal with China, especially to offset the so-called maximum pressure campaign by the U.S., but you should not rely on them as any sort of liberation, because at the end of the day, the mindset is that only self-sufficiency can help Iran.
So then my next question, after all of those things you just talked about, and you kind of mentioned this in passing, is, you know, Iran is inundated with all this foreign-backed opposition media. Some of it's supported by the Saudis, by the Americans, by the Israelis, by pro-Shah Iranians in the West. So I'm curious, are these attempts influential or successful in shaping Iranian perceptions? What's their impact?
That's right. So there are numerous foreign medias that Iranians consume. So some examples are the U.S.-funded Voice of America, the British-backed BBC Persian. Then you have what is probably a Saudi-funded Iran International, The Guardian broke the story on that, even though Iran International denies it, but it appears that they have Saudi funding and also they're based in the UK. And then you have so many media, so VOA, BBC Persian, Iran International, these are some of the big ones. And then you also have all these satellite channels coming out of LA where the Iranian diaspora, the regime change Iranian diaspora is, and they also bombard Iranians on a daily with regime change propaganda. And Iranians consume this. So a lot of Iranians, especially middle and upper middle classes, have satellites in their homes. And they consume this news. And actually, the difference with the U.S. is really staggering, because if you are an American and, you know, you turn on the TV or even open your internet browser, you will not have much access to the foreign medias, right? So, I mean, the big tech kind of censoring a lot of alternative news and foreign medias for American access, especially after 2016. And on TV, you cannot access it. So I remember, I mean, Russia Today, I think, used to be on some, you could access it on US TV, but then I think they got rid of it after 2016. And also Iran's Press TV, that has actually better, I would say, it has better programming on domestic US politics in some cases than American media does. They were completely taken off satellite networks. So if you have a dish in the US, you cannot even access Press TV. And then if you go on YouTube or Facebook and Twitter, a lot of times their pages keep getting taken down, mm-hmm. and they have to create a new page and so on. So, and I mean, even if the Americans had access, so even if there were not obstacles, most Americans kind of have this trust in their own media, and the idea is that, well, I only watch, you know, my NPR and my Fox News and CNN and whatever. But Iranians are actually the opposite. So the idea is that, well, not everyone, but a lot of Iranians, the idea is that I can, you know, I just want to watch the satellite channels, right? And I mean, if it was good programming, I would be okay with it. But the problem is that a lot of it is just regime change propaganda, and Iranians consume it. And what ends up happening is that these Western positions get reproduced. So just like with the China agreement, the 25-year agreement, the immediate idea on the streets was that, oh, well, this is, you know, that they have sold out the country, right? Because they were consuming those medias. And again, I don't have some naivety that the China agreement is all good and everything is good about it. I mean, there is a potential that penetration of global capital through the agreement would disturb local economies, mm-hmm. right? But I'm saying, since we don't have much concrete evidence right now, we shouldn't speculate too much. And definitely the colonization argument does not hold in this case.
No, totally. You know, we talked about sanctions already, but I wanted to ask you, you know, when we think about sanctions on Venezuela or sanctions on Syria, they're just completely suffocating and have devastated the countries to such a degree. But Iran seems to have thrived a little bit under these crushing, brutal sanctions, right? Well, these other countries, like even Iraq in the 90s, you know, completely devastated. Or, you know, in Syria and Venezuela, the kind of suffering we're seeing today is actually similar to Iraq in the 90s. So why is that? Why is it that Iran has been able to be more resilient against this sanction, this brutal, crippling attempt to starve the country?
That's right. So I think a big part of that goes back to the national production and the resistance economy that we were talking about. So Iran has very strong national production industries. And in fact, it exports a lot of products to the Iraqi economy and the economy in Afghanistan. So there's a very strong national production industry, and I was mentioning, so from hygienic products to refrigerators to even cars, a lot of these are produced in Iran, and a lot of them are of competitive quality. I mean, things like laptops, Iran doesn't produce, but it's even producing cars right now, and in a lot of cases, it might not be as good as a Toyota, but it's still, you can get a decent Iranian car, Iranian main car. So there are all these, and what actually makes it interesting too, this strong national production industry, is that it safeguards Iran from the lowering of quality that comes with globalization. So if you go to a vegetable market or a fruit market in Iran, it's way better than even the farmer's market in the US, right? So when you get a fruit, it doesn't look very good. So you look at it and like, you know, this looks kind of beat up and it's not that pretty. But once you eat it, the taste is just heavenly, right? And it was even better before, because I think, I mean, the globalization, even though we had the revolution, globalization does leave some impact. So from my parents, I hear that the fruit was even better in their days. But yeah, because Iran has this national production, including in food and agriculture, the fruits taste amazing.
Yeah, that's also true about fruits and vegetables. Like when they look super pristine, they actually don't taste as good. There's something to be said about that.
You know what's funny about that is there was this trend in Iran where they sell what is called miveh majlisi, and miveh majlisi means basically like party fruits, right? Mm. And the party fruit is the stuff they import that looks really big and really pretty. It's a lot more expensive, and people buy it for parties because it looks so luxurious. But then the Iranian fruit doesn't look as good, right? But it's a lot cheaper. And then if you want to eat good fruit, that's what you get.
Yeah.
If you want to have a party, you get the
foreign. You get the bad tasting but pretty fruit. that's funny. I want to go back to Iranian sentiments real quick. I wanted to ask you about Qasem Soleimani. Does the killing of Qasem Soleimani still resonate with people in Iran? And what did he mean to Iranians?
That's right. So I think to understand Qasem Soleimani, we have to understand the context in which he was raised. So again, giving some history here. What happens after the revolution is that there's this concern that there would be a coup d'etat again against the revolution, as there was in 1953 against Mossadegh's nationalization of oil. So Khomeini actually institutes the Revolutionary Guard, and a lot of the members come from the communities and from the revolutionaries. And the Revolutionary Guard, or the Sepah, develops parallel to the army. Right, so in this way, they're trying to minimize the possibilities that there would be a coup d'etat against the revolution. And the reason is that a lot of Global South armies were colonially manufactured, right? So you could have had a new prime minister or a revolutionary president, but then if the army was colonially manufactured and dependent on the West, that wouldn't really matter, because these were the guys with guns. So the revolutionary president could be easily taken out in a coup d'etat, right? So Khomeini's idea was that, and I think he might have been following some of the socialist revolutions in this case, is that you build a parallel institution that is armed, but it's not the army. And so Revolutionary Guard comes about, and even though it has grown quite powerful over the years, it still does have some popular base. Mm-hmm. Right, so we can't really see Qasem Soleimani as, you know, an abstract general, like an American general that people might have heard of at some point. And if that person dies, you know, there is a memorial or something, and then it's kind of over. But then Qasem Soleimani, especially because he comes from a working class background himself, he comes from a poor community, and he was also active during the Iran and Iraq War, he's seen as a national hero. Mm. Right. So there's this reverence and respect for him. And then he's not, and again, not, we shouldn't compare him to that abstract general. Right. So for a lot of people, he was more like a community elder or a teacher. And that's how they looked at him. And I would say it's not just Iranians who remember him and will remember him for many years to come. It's also generally the anti-imperialist peoples around the world. And I think this is one big reason that the big tech was so was censoring so hard when he was assassinated, because I remember I had a very, very descriptive, neutral post about him on my Facebook. And I just kind of described his working class background and his wishes to be buried in his hometown, and kind of said, you know, who he was and stuff. There was nothing celebratory about him in the post. But I remember it got taken without anyone reporting, because it was a private post just sharing with my friends. And without anyone reporting it, even though maybe there were snitches in my profile and they reported it, who knows? But without anyone reporting it, the post was taken down. The post was taken down, and Instagram and Facebook were engaged in that campaign of taking down anything about Qasem Soleimani, including pictures and including the neutral posts. So I think the negative ones stayed up, because I saw some negative posts that stayed up. But the neutral, the positive ones were all taken down. So I think that also shows how popular he was around the world more generally.
Yeah, I had something taken down actually a few months ago. So it's not even like this just happened immediately after he died. Tech companies continue to try to control the narrative about him even more than a year after he was murdered by the US. I want to turn to a slightly different issue, but I think it's interesting. I'm curious about, you know, every once in a while we hear that there's this Jewish community in Iran. And, you know, when I think about Jews across the Middle East, like they, you know, some of the oldest Jewish communities in the world were living in the Middle East before the creation of Israel, whether it was, you know, Arab Jews in Baghdad, Syria, there was even some in Lebanon. And because of Zionism and the creation of Israel and this attempt to get, you know, Jews around the world to come to Israel and just the way that imposing this Jewish sectarian state on the Middle East fractured these various societies, you don't have Jews in Syria anymore or in Iraq anymore or in Morocco anymore. But in Iran, you still continue to have this Jewish community that doesn't seem interested in moving to Israel ever, which is a good thing. I'm just curious, like, from your perspective, why is that? Why is it that, you know, the Jewish community in Iran has been more resilient against Zionism and its attempt to try to, you know, basically remove Jews from the region and put them all in Israel?
That's right. So I would say, there is, just to modify that the premise of the question a bit, there were some Jewish immigration outside Iran after the revolution. But as you correctly say, there's also a big Jewish community, at least comparatively, that stays in Iran. And they have their own member of parliament, and they have political representation, and they also have places of worship that they can attend. And I think a lot of them identify more with Iranian nationalism than they identify with Zionism. So if you look at Zionism as a form of nationalism, between those competing nationalisms, they identify more with the Iranian nationalism. And in fact, a lot of them fought in the Iran and Iraq war, and there's a mural of the Jewish martyrs on the intersection of Wadi As and Mir Damad Street. So there's actually a big computer store. It's, multiple-storied building on the intersection of, so if anybody from your audience travels to Iran, intersection of Mir Damad and Wadi As, it's right across the bus station in Tehran. You see this big mural of Iranian Jews who were martyred in the Iran and Iraq war. So I think at the end of the day, it has to do with them identifying more with Iranian nationalism than they identify with Zionism.
Hey, that's really interesting. And then I want to go a little bit more to you personally. Can you tell people a little bit about your field of study, which I think is really interesting and obviously unique, which you're working on your PhD. And what's your personal academic interests? What are they and why?
All right. So the esoteric responses I have to give.
Yeah.
If I want to say it very broadly, I work on the intersection of political and intellectual histories of Iran and the Persianate world. And so the Persianate world are the Persian-speaking cultures outside Iran, because a lot of times when we think about the Persian language, we think of Iran. But Persian was actually written and produced in courts, royal courts around the world. So you had Persian courts in India, you had them in Central Asia, and you also had Persian-speaking intellectuals in the Caucasus, for example. So the Persian world is not just Iran, but can include the Caucasus, Central Asia, and South Asia. So I work on the histories, the intellectual and political histories of Iran and the Persianate world. And most specifically, I'm writing my dissertation on the transformation from pre-national or pre-modern education to national education. So how was it that pre-modern education changed and became the national education that we're all used to, you know, the schools that we went to every day. A lot of them had a very, very big discipline. So you had to cut your nails, your hair had to be proper, at least in Iran, that's how it was. So I'm looking at how that transition was made, because pre-modern classical education was very different than modern education. So that's my immediate dissertation topic. And I guess you also asked why. Should I respond to that?
Yeah, yeah. Why? Like what brought you to, you know, be so interested in this issue that you'd spend years researching it, I guess. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I mean, maybe not this specific issue, but just generally studying Iranian history and Persian histories, and also sometimes giving commentaries on current affairs that connect to Iran. A big reason is that because of my bicultural and bilingual abilities, and the problem is that if you follow especially the media, there are a lot of people who claim to know some Persian, but the Persian is not very good, or they've never traveled to Iran. And I mean, you don't really have to travel to say the right things, but then you do have to know the language, because if you don't know the language, then you cannot access the culture and the history. So a lot of your interpretations will not be very good. So I saw that there's this kind of need for bicultural and actually bilingual writers and a specialist on Iran and on Iranian history. And I thought that, well, you know, I have these abilities, might as well put them to use.
And then I'm just curious politically, like you have a pretty interesting background. We had been talking before you moved to the US when you were a teenager at a pretty interesting time from Iran, right? It was just before 9/11, which was a pretty difficult time to, I think, be from anywhere, whether it's Iran or anywhere in the Middle East, just in terms of being that ethnicity, but you actually like grew up in Iran. And so you came up in the US, you know, in high school. I'm curious, like, what was that experience like being, you know, going from somewhere like Iran to coming to this place in America where just being from there causes this sort of, you know, instinctive reaction that's kind of negative most of the time for most people.
That's right. And I mean, I think we talked about this too, that, you know, if I tell a Yemeni or an Iraqi who's not happy with Iranian intervention in their country, that I'm from Iran, the reception is usually very positive. It's same in Lebanon. So in Lebanon, I mean, there are certain Shia neighborhoods like Dahiya that might be more Iran friendly, but then there are other neighborhoods that are not. But even in those neighborhoods, if I say I'm from Iran, usually the reception is very positive, because I would say in West Asia, or Middle East, people distinguish between the governments and the people. So the idea is that, especially because in most Middle Eastern histories, the nation and the state had parallel developments, right? Because a lot of the states were just colonial transplants, right? So they had kind of colonial connections, and the nation never felt that close to them, right? So you have this national history, you have the state history that are developing parallel. But then in the West, I think the nation state, because it's indigenous to the West, the nation state, it grew more organically and more, you know, entangled. But yeah, people in the Middle East distinguish between the people and the government. So if I tell them I'm from Iran, and even if they don't like something about the Iranian state, they're still super friendly. But in the US, it was the opposite, because, you know, I come and I'm excited to share my culture and my knowledge of my history and whatever. And I'm talking to them, and I say something about Iran, or they ask me where I'm from because they hear the accent, and, well, you know, the accent according to them, because everybody has an accent.
right.
Yeah, and so I tell them I'm from Iran, and usually the reactions were very negative. So it was almost like, you know, like as if I've insulted their mother, you know, as if, you know, I have just insulted. It's like. So I never understood that. And I think it's part of it has to do with this media propaganda we talked about, because the amount of misinformation Americans get about these fabricated enemies or real enemies, but a lot of misinformation, and they identify with their state. That's why, you know, when they talk about the military, like if you talk, I mean, we talked about how Qasem Soleimani is very popular in Iran. But then if the Iranians are talking about the Artesh, the military, or even about the Sepah, the Revolutionary Guard, they don't usually say we. They don't say, like, we went there. They just, you know, identify the institution. But in the U.S., if you're talking about the military, you always say when we went to Iraq, or when we went to, you know, X and Y, or, you know, our men, our military, right? So they strongly identify with the state. And I think that's one reason the reactions were so negative. And I guess part of the purpose of your show, I think, is to kind of counter some of these misinformation and negative views that Americans have.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, I also think it's interesting, like, I'm curious from your own personal experience, did that change in college? Cause you also, you went to Columbia in New York. Was that different from your high school experience once people are a little bit older, maybe they're like adults and in certain departments, if they're studying in certain departments, maybe they have a bit of a different attitude. Does that response that you might've gotten when you were younger, has that changed or is it the same?
Yeah. Columbia is not a good example because I'm at a department called Middle Eastern South Asian.
Right.
and we have a lot of, anti-imperialist professors. I think you had actually Professor Joseph Massad on your show. So when you deal with people like him, talk to people like him, they're not going to have those attitudes, you know, they know what's up. So, Colombia is not the best example, but I would say the broader culture. So in New York, you can still get, you know, these like stupid questions. Like people ask you, if you tell them that you're traveling to Iran, they ask you, oh, is it dangerous? You know, what are they going to do to you? Are they going to kidnap you? It's actually really funny because I remember somebody once came up to me. This is in New York. I think he was a New Yorker, presumably. And he asked me after he found out I was from Iran, he asked me that, why is it that Iran kidnaps Americans? And it was actually funny because, I mean, it is true that Iran has imprisoned a number of Americans or dual nationals, but then it cannot kidnap them because it's not a private actor, right? It's a state actor, and the state actors do not kidnap people, they imprison people. So I think the sense of misinformation, also entitlement is so large that, you know, if I'm in Iran and something happens to me, I'm kidnapped, I'm not imprisoned, right? So,
that's a good point. Yeah. America kidnap. If you want to use that language, I guess America kidnaps a lot of people who come from South America. If you want to talk about, you know, if you want to turn imprisonment into kidnapping, but yeah, it's an interesting concept, or it's an interesting framework that Americans view Iran in. And I think it was interesting also you were telling me, because you were just explaining how the reaction you get, like from here in Lebanon, people, even if they might be anti-Iranian like government, they're still like, oh, you're Iranian, that's really cool. Whereas what about like Arab Americans in the US? Is there a different reaction you'll get? Does the American part of them like kind of cancel out the Middle Eastern side of them if they grew up in the US?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I would say generally not. Generally, if they're Arab Americans, especially because they've received so much xenophobia and racism, they're generally not like that. They generally don't ask offensive questions or get kind of, you know, put on a guard.
Ah, you're Iranian. Ah! Yeah.
it's not that explicit, but yeah.
Well, Naveed, thank you so much for joining me and giving me so much of your time and our listeners and viewers. I personally learned a lot, and I hope those who get to watch this also learned a lot. Is there anywhere where people can follow along with your writing that you'd like to give a shout out to?
You know, honestly, just my email. I mean, I have some social media, but I don't really, it's not really public. It's just mostly a close community because I don't want trolls on there. But if you want to contact me for any matter, my email is the best place to reach me. So it's my first name, Naveed, NAVID, period. My last name, Zarinal, ZARRINAL, @ columbia.edu.
Naveed, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.